Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Professional mountain biker Adam Craig says it's one of the top three places in the universe he's ridden. Where is this magical mountain biking nirvana? It's none other than Brevard, North Carolina, home to Pisgah National Forest and DuPont Recreational Forest. The area boasts over 300 miles of peerless single track, not to mention hundreds of miles of gravel roads, creating a near endless array of routes, terrains, and challenges to explore. Four vibrant bike shops will get you sorted, whether you need gear, service, or a top-notch rental. Top it off with an array of craft breweries, cafes, and gathering spots that have earned Brevard the title as one of the best small towns in America in 2021. It all adds up to a premier mountain biking destination you'll want to experience for yourself. Find out more at explorebrevard.com. Hey everybody, welcome to the Single Tracks Podcast. My name is Jeff, and today my guest is Scott Morris. Scott is a self-described lifelong mountain biker, trail mapper, and programmer. He's the creator of Track Leaders, a live tracking website for bikepacking races, and Topo Fusion mapping software. Thanks for joining us, Scott.
Good to be here, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
So how did you first make the connection between mountain biking and computer programming?
Yeah, it was really the GPS system coming online, or at least me becoming aware of it.
But I think
I think the timing was good in that it was pretty new, right when I was coming out of high school and really getting into computer programming. Mm-hmm. And so there wasn't really, you know, I think people were trying to figure out what the GPS system could do and what new applications there were. And yeah, they were. From a very early age, I got pretty interested in computers and programming. Mm-hmm. I was a pretty nerdy kid growing up. Like, I mean, like, you know, I had glasses going into kindergarten. Like, I never like that level of nerdiness. Yeah. And yeah, I got super into like Nintendo games and computer games. And I always kind of thought about making my own company or making my own games. And I thought that was going to be my way of combining my two interests of computers and games.
Yeah.
But when I was about 13 or 14, after many failed attempts from my dad to try to get me to do like team sports and just awful at baseball and basketball and all these things that people did, I think one of his last ditch efforts was to get me a very crappy mountain bike and take me out on the trails. And man, I just fell hard for mountain biking. I mean, I just,
cool.
Yeah, I absolutely loved it and started mountain biking every day. I think when I was 14, maybe, at least not. Well, every day I could, I guess not in the winter, but I was super lucky to have trails that I could ride to from my house. So it was like ultimate freedom of being able to ride from home to trails before I even had a driver's license. So mountain biking, was just became everything to me, and computer games quickly fell out the wayside as not being very real. And so then, it shifted to trying to combine something with outdoors and mountain biking and programming. And the GPS system was, I think it was online in the early 90s and became available to the public some years after that. But it was with this thing called selective availability that maybe you remember that, maybe not, but you do.
That
was when they were adding the error, you know, a systematic random error to the GPS signal.
Right.
And I remember my brother borrowed a GPS from someone, and we tracked this really long ride that we did, and it was so cool to be able to see, you know, where we had gone on this map. But there was like big random shifts where all of a sudden it would be way off the trail. I mean, way much bigger than, you know, like errors you'd see today from GPSs.
Yeah.
But, and so I kind of, I thought that could be something, but the error was really hard to get too excited about. But luckily they turned that selective availability off. They, meaning the government, the U.S. government.
Yeah.
In 2000, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And then it started working really good, and Garmin started making, you know, really small handheld devices that you could put on your handlebars. And yeah, I thought, okay, maybe there's something here.
Yeah, I remember you and I connected early on, like, yeah, I think it was early 2000s when, you know, I was playing around with GPS as well and trying to figure out, like, how could you create maps and share them with other people? And I remember at the time, like, didn't you do, like, some graduate studies or something around this idea of, like, how do you take GPS data and, like, make it more accurate, or, like, take a bunch of people who ride the same trail and, like, figure out what is, like, the true path versus, like, all these paths that have slight errors in them. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I was doing my grad work in Tucson at the University of Arizona in computer science, and mm-hmm. kind of had aspirations of not only starting, like, a small company, but also doing research and trying to solve problems that people hadn't thought of. With GPS data, especially related to the outdoors. And so, one of my papers was exactly what you just said, which was to take, you know, a collection of rides in an area that could be from one person or could be from multiple people, and combine it into a GPS network that gives you only the unique trails instead of, you know, multiple versions of it. And, yeah, published that paper. A smarter person probably would not have published that and made more commercial.
Right. Yeah, because everybody, like, you know, Strava now, like,
yeah,
you know, is a thing. They're able to kind of figure out, like, okay, you and 10 other people rode this exact same trail segment. And, you know, I mean, but at the time, like, you know, early 2000s, it was like, this is a hard problem to solve.
Yeah, that's right. And Strava does it very, very well, and a couple other people do now. But based on that paper, I did get a few job offers or inquiries. And I remember being in an interview or two, and people straight up asked me, why did you, I mean, this is like a really complex algorithm you came up with. Why did you publish it?
Wow. Interesting.
And I don't know if anyone, you know, really used that. Certainly it was the idea. I don't know if they actually used the algorithm or got them started. But that's just how the academic world is. Like, you share things, and I'd rather be known as someone that can solve problems than just be known for someone that solved one problem, I guess.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, did you work with, like, any of the GPS companies over the years? Because, again, like, the GPSs, you mentioned the Garmins, like, when those came out, like, those weren't great. Like, I think most people kind of understood, like, these could be a lot better, and there's, like, a lot of issues with them. So were you able to, like, work with any of these companies, or have you been focused more, like, on the software side?
I kind of always treated the hardware as something I just had to deal with process the errors and do what I could. And, I never really had, like, a good open channel with Garmin or anything to give feedback. Other than that, occasionally they became aware of what I was doing and wanted to hire me. I refused multiple times.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, so yeah, I mean, still kind of back in the early 2000s, you and your brother started Topo Fusion, created this software for viewing topo maps on a computer and being able to overlay GPS data on them. And now that's something that we take for granted, I think. You know, I mean, we've got Google Maps and all these online solutions. But what made you decide to start Topo Fusion? Like, what was the problem you were trying to solve back then?
The biggest thing was that every other piece of software that we knew of or found at that time, we determined that it pretty much sucked. That's really the reason we couldn't find anything that did what we wanted to do, which was just have a really clean, easy to use interface for loading your tracks and planning rides and doing it in a way that was, like Talorme Topo USA was one of them, and the interface was just atrocious. I mean, you couldn't zoom in and out the tracks. You could never tell where the tracks were going. And what else was back there? Maybe National Geographic Topo with an exclamation point.
Yeah. And both of those, I remember using both of those, and they were, didn't they like come on CD-ROMs and stuff?
Right.
Like, I don't feel like they were even internet connected, whereas Topo Fusion was, right? Like you were getting the map tiles, or was it like a self-contained?
Yeah, you could just download a really small file, even off of, this was dial-up days back then. Mm-hmm. And then the maps came from Terra server, Microsoft Terra server.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that was a really cool opportunity. It was not only the GPS system and Garmin's coming out, but also, yeah, that there was this map server that was public domain and that we could download and display. And then, yeah, you didn't have to like go to the store and buy a piece of software in a box that had a bunch of CDs.
Right.
And then the maps were static, so it was a different, little different model of mapping software. But, mainly we just wanted a program to map our own rides the way we thought that it should be done. And so we saw this need for something that we wanted, and it seemed like we were the right people to fit that need. So anytime you're in that kind of situation, it's a pretty special place to be. And Topo Fusion was, we just last month, a couple weeks ago, we was the 20th anniversary of the first release of Topo Fusion. It's 2002, which I think single tracks, you started a little before that. Is that right?
Yeah, we started the website in like 98, 99.
Wow. Cool.
Didn't start doing mapping stuff until a few years after that.
Okay. Yep. Because, I remember some really early on conversations with you about, mapping and showing things. And maybe in the 90s, you were more of like a blog kind of a...
Yeah, I mean, we always were about helping people find trails, but just mapping wasn't a thing yet. Like, so you also started the Arizona Trail Race in the early 2000s. And since that time, the Arizona Trail Race and others like it seem to have really exploded in popularity. I'm curious to know, like, what the growing pains were like along the way. Like, was this kind of like a easy and natural thing to do, or what was it like starting a bikepacking race back in the early 2000s?
Yeah, the Arizona Trail Race, I think, similar to Topo Fusion, grew out of a need that I saw, that something that didn't exist, and also something that I wanted to do myself, which was to race my bike on single track for multiple days.
Mm.
And at the time, the only things that were similar were the Great Divide Race, which was the predecessor to the Tour Divide. There was something called the Grand Loop that Mike Kuriak put on out in Utah, but nothing that was on single track. And so I did those races, and I failed spectacularly at Great Divide Race. I made all the mistakes you could possibly make. But also it was dirt roads, and that was my excuse at the time. Was like, oh, well, it's all dirt roads, but I'm a mountain biker. The truth is, it's hard no matter what kind of surface you're doing it on and what the conditions are. But this was 2006 that I started the first AZT 300, the 300 mile version of the Arizona Trail Race, and at the time, it felt like something new. I mean, in reality, it's just riding your bike for a lot of hours and a lot of miles. And we know now that the surface, whatever, doesn't matter if there's a lot of hike a bike or if it's rideable. But at the time, I wasn't really sure it was a good idea, to be honest. I mean, 300 miles of stringing together rides that had crushed me individually. You know, it was like putting together 12 rides, that all day rides that just absolutely destroyed me on their own. And so what was going to happen?
Yeah. Were you just like looking at a map, or, I mean, it sounds like you had ridden most of it, or had you ridden all of it just like at different times?
Yeah, I had done it as a tour. I had ridden the Arizona Trail from end to end, with a friend of mine, Lee Blackwell. And it'd taken 20 some odd days. And, so I knew the trail pretty well, and I knew this racing thing was really Mike Kuryak's idea of self-supported and unorganized bikepacking races, although we didn't call it bikepacking at that time. But, but there wasn't one on single track. And so that was what was super interesting to me, was to put it on this trail, that was coming together, at the time. And, I think the jury's still out on whether it is a good idea or not. I think if you ask people right after they finish, most people, would say it's not a good idea, but it's, yeah, no, it's been an awesome thing. I think a lot of people have fallen in love with the trail and with bikepacking, and, you know, grown a lot and pushed a lot of limits. And, that's been super rewarding and super awesome, to see. But, as far as growing pains, there have definitely been some. I mean, there's always been little controversies and things that happened, but I don't really think it's been anything bigger than what you would expect out of a group of humans trying to coordinate with each other and communicate with each other and compromise on different ideas and the way they see stuff. So,
right.
I think the bikepacking community is really awesome. And, I don't think it's been outrageous or higher than what you'd expect. And as far as popularity, you know, they're still not really exploding, I think. At least the triple.
It's like the idea of it is really popular, but sounds like people aren't actually like doing it.
Well,
yet. Is that kind of where we're at?
Yeah, I think it's just that it's really, really hard. I mean, it's one thing to look at routes and, you know, pack your bags and stuff. But once you get out there, it's really hard. And it's hard. It's so hard that there aren't a lot of people who race year after year, you know, bikepackers. There's exceptions. There's definitely people who are long time bikepack racers and who can pull it off consistently. But most people I know, and myself included, did it for a number of years. And then, kind of decided that it was super hard and maybe not that good for your body and your mind to be pushing sleep deprivation and pushing that many hours on the bike. I'm thinking mostly about the Triple Crown races, which is Tour Divide, Colorado Trail Race, and the AZT. And those have not, you know, they haven't gotten super huge. The AZT and the Colorado Trail have a limit of 74 riders.
And that's I'm guessing based on the Forest Service permit,
correct,
right?
Yeah, that's the,
if you have over 75, you need a permit.
That's right. Yeah, that's the non-commercial, non-permitted group or competitive event limit of 74 people. And so, you know, they've pushed against that a little bit, or maybe had to turn away a couple people, but then people get in usually with the wait list when people cancel. But it's not like, you know, 500 people are trying to sign up for these events. And I mean, interest has increased, but I think they're somewhat self-limiting just because they are so hard, especially in the last 5 or 6 years. You know, there's tons of new bikepacking routes all over the country and world, and in that sense bikepacking races definitely races are growing, but you know, are we ever going to see 2,000 people wanting to race the AZT? Maybe not.
Yeah, the Arizona Trail race too. I remember it's being sort of unique, and maybe this is when you were kind of, you know, looking at going from the 300 or the 350 to the 700 or 750, like the full route of it. And part of the route.
That's right.
Had to go through the Grand Canyon, I guess, where, you know, you're obviously not allowed to bike. And so part of that was like, you had to break down bikes and carry them. So, I mean, was when you were planning this out, were you thinking about those things? Like, oh, we need to get permits. We need to like ask permission. Or was it more just like, hey, this is out there. Like, we want to do it and we're going to just make it happen. And
yeah, I'd say more of the latter.
We need to after the fact.
You know, throw it out there and keep it small. And it wasn't really on people's radar to begin with. And then as it slowly grew, there was concerns that, yeah, we'd get attention from land managers and such. And I knew it was never going to be fully a secret. Yeah.
It's sort of the approach to software too, right? Like I'm making this connection now where in the software world, you don't like ask permission. Like you just do stuff and then like sort of figure it out later or like regulations catch up with it or whatever. Yeah. Sort of that same ethos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You adapt as things develop, but you sort of put it out there and see how it goes. So yeah, there was certainly never a master plan for Topo Fusion or track leaders or there's a trail race. It was just, they all seemed like really good ideas and to put out into the world. Yeah.
So another project of yours is bikepacking.net. And on there, there's a page listing ultra endurance records for races like the Tour Divide and the Hurricane 300. And I know that's a resource I've used at times, like writing articles or, you know, doing research on athletes. Just seeing like who has the record for this route or what is the record. Are you able to keep the list up to date? It seems like a really tough task to like keep the records for one, but also to like verify them and stuff. Like, is that something that you are able to take on or want to take on or does like, should that even exist? I guess I just have lots of questions.
Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. That page is kind of a funny one. I mean, I started it just because it didn't really exist. I just wanted to sort of coalesce, a few different events into one page. Mm-hmm. But the idea is really just to give something people to shoot for and aspire to. And I don't think it's claiming really to be mm-hmm. anything super official. You know, I mean, the bikepacking stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there is nothing else is uh-huh. the problem. I mean,
yeah.
I see it as a problem as a journalist, as someone who's like, okay, like I need to make sure this is accurate or this is a fact or whatever. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of the only thing that's out there for that.
You know, Track Leaders has a pretty good archive of a lot of old events, but it doesn't necessarily call out records and such. But we're maybe in the best position to possibly verify those things. But the reality is in my opinion, it's totally up to the individual race directors as to what they consider the races or what they consider the records are.
Yeah.
And so if they tell me mm-hmm. that this such and such record is broken by this person, you know, then I'll update that page. And I don't take responsibility for being the ultimate word on whether a record is official or not. But there is kind of a need for something a little bit better than that. And possibly that's a new website like the FKT one in the running world.
Right. Right. And I've seen that one. And again, it's like, that's a really tough thing to do. Like I remember reading years ago that there's some record or database of people who've climbed Mount Everest. And, you know, there's different records like mountaineering records and all this like paperwork exists somewhere like in Nepal or something. Like some person has decided to like keep this up and, you know, people will like debate like, oh, did so-and-so actually summit? And, you know, there will be like years of back and forth, like, you know, you need to produce evidence and, you know, like all kinds of stuff like that. And it's interesting now because like FKTs are becoming popular, you know, especially with the pandemic, a lot of athletes saw it, I guess, as a way to like get out and compete with, you know, kind of on their own terms and on their own time. So like, it seems like it's becoming more of a thing where people want to know, did this person do it or who has the record? but it also seems like it's a really hard thing to do, even with today's technology. Like, do you see potential problems with that in terms of just like the politics of it and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think so. And you know, maybe we're at a little bit of a turning point with that, with more higher profile riders getting into FKTs and bikepacking a little bit. I may be a little naive thinking that, yeah, this one web page that I maintain is sufficient, you know, going forward. I think it has been in the past. There hasn't really been too many super controversial FKTs, but yeah, it could change in the future. And there is definitely a good argument to having something more like the running model, where there's a more official. Yeah, you know, I don't know. It's hard. Bikepackers are very independent people, and you know, I think a lot of people bristle at the idea of a governing body or any one official saying anything. And I've always kind of viewed that records and wins and routes are ultimately subject to, you know, the I don't want to say popular opinion, but you know, what the community thinks in the end is the most important thing. And names on web pages are in some ways less important than, you know, what people think about a particular effort or a record. So
yeah, I feel like bikepacking is unique, you know, especially these races. I guess when we're talking about the big races, like, it's, there's like this tension between like official and unofficial, right? Like yes, there are some records and we are timing it, and you know, there's someone who finishes first. But at the same time, we want it to be laid back and we want it to be simple and we want it to just be like, yeah, you know,
yeah,
this is unofficial, yeah, but it's official. Like, yeah, it's, it's a really fine line.
It is. Yeah. And we dance on both sides of that, I think, with these, events. And, to be honest, that's part of one of the reasons that I stepped down from, putting the Arizona Trail Race on, is that dance is a little bit stressful. And, mostly from the perspective of land managers who might possibly decide that, you know, it's too far on the side of official or not following the rules. And particularly with the AZT is kind of unique in that it crosses Grand Canyon National Park. And it's kind of amazing that that has been allowed to go on for this many years. But, you know, it's one of the most visited national parks in the country, and understandably they have a lot of challenges to managing people and a lot of challenges coming up with rules. And you know, I wouldn't completely blame them if one day someone high up in the park decides that the AZT race is not something that should be tolerated. you know, and so yeah, that definitely caused me some stress, and I think it causes the new race director, John Schilling, some stress as well. But, you know, it's worth dealing with as well, because that race is such a special thing and such an amazing thing. So I'm really grateful that he has taken that responsibility on.
Yeah. Yeah, that, for sure. I mean, that's what makes bikepacking what it is too, right? Like, you don't want to mess with it too much. But yeah, at the same time, there are those challenges. So tell us about Track Leaders. What led you to create that, and how does it work?
Okay, yeah. Track Leaders is kind of a joint venture between myself and Matthew Lee. And Matthew's probably best known for being in the film Ride the Divide, which was kind of the first major bikepacking race movie, and probably still the best known one, maybe, but followed the 2008 Tour Divide race, I think.
And he's won it a number of times, right? Including in 2008.
Yeah. I think he raced 7 years in a row. It finished 7 years in a row, and won it 4 or 5 times out of those 7. But, he took over, well, he created the Tour Divide race, which was just a spin-off of the Great Divide race from Mike Kuriak. And Tour Divide, in the end, Matthew had the enthusiasm and the love of the route. And that's why people went to Tour Divide as opposed to the GDR. But it became the the main Divide race. And right at that time, around 2008, 2007, Globalstar started producing the Spot device for the first time. And so this was a really new thing. And somehow Matthew heard about it. And he had this revelation that this could be a way to actually follow the Tour Divide race.
Yeah.
Make it a spectator race in a way that doesn't intrude on the experience of the racers.
Okay.
I think, that was a key point to him, that you should still be able to go out there and disconnect and ride your bike and have it be a relatively pure experience if that's what you're looking for. And so he was able to get Spot to, I think, sponsor one of those early Tour Divides, and got a fleet of, well, I say a fleet of Spot devices, but I think there was like 15 people in the race maybe at that time. But and he kind of knew that I was, from Top of Fusion, knew that I was a GPS nerd and programmer. And I had met Matthew in the 2005 Great Divide Race, which I did not finish, and he did. But I had met him there, and so kind of knew, well, it was a pretty small community at that point. But the funny part was that I think in one of those early AZT races, he offered to let me use those Spot trackers that he had got for the previous year's Tour Divide.
Oh, cool.
And this was a ploy to get me to do the mapping software for him, mostly, I think. But I said no. I said no. I had reservations about what it was going to do to the event and not only the experience of the riders, but also kind of the, what's the right word, the making it more visible to the public or land managers. And so I turned him down that first year of the AZT and said, no, I don't know that this is a good thing for bikepacking. But then over the next couple of months, I realized that this was going to be a really, really cool thing for bikepack racing, that I was a big fan of Tour Divide and Colorado Trail and some of these other events that were coming out now. And it was something I had to be a part of, and my skills were just like perfectly aligned to do it in a way that, where I was not only a participant, but in a fan. So I felt like I could do a pretty good job on it. So, we started collaborating and started tracking not only bikepacking races, but dog sled races and sailing races and running races. And so now we track quite a few different kinds, but bikepacking is still the main thing we're interested in. And probably in terms of the number of events that we track, we track more bikepacking races than anything else. But
cool. Well, so yeah, you said that the whole genesis for Track Leaders was around the time that the Spot devices came out, 2007, 2008.
Yep.
You know, that's a lifetime ago in terms of technology, right? Like that was maybe right around the time the iPhone came out or just before. So is Spot, like, is that still the best way to track these outdoor races? I mean, I know obviously there's a lot of places, especially on a race like Tour Divide, I'm sure there's lots of places where there's no, cell phone service or anything like that. But do you see other devices like smartphones becoming viable for doing this anytime soon? I mean, right now you and I are talking on a satellite internet connection, right? Like you've got internet wherever you go. So do you see that like sort of shifting, or are we still going to be using Spots for the next 10 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, we're talking, I'm camping right now and I've got Starlink set up.
It's a great connection too. It's not like,
it's super fast.
Dial-up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's changing things, for mobile living for sure. But, as far as satellite trackers go, it's a really good question. I wish I knew the answer, of course, so I could plan our business model.
Yeah.
But and there's a few things coming out soon, probably in the next 2 or 3 years. Like the next version of Starlink satellites are going to have essentially a cell tower on them
Oh, wow.
for low low bandwidth, I think it's T-Mobile will be, we'll be able to talk to these satellites and send emergency texts anytime you can see a satellite, and probably some data too, and maybe tracking will come out of that as well. So that'd be through your phone.
And the new iPhones too, like they have the SOS feature, which I don't know that that like,
that's right.
You know, obviously it's not for playing around. It's not for just like going on a race, but yeah, it seems like that's where we're heading.
It could be. Yeah. I mean, I think that Globalstar is devoting the bulk of their satellite bandwidth to the new iPhone when that comes out. And so we could see tracking through that as well. But I think there's still a need for a dedicated tracking device. It depends on the event a little bit. You know, if you're talking about an ultra running race or a bike race that's not one of these unofficial, like, you know, joker races like I put on where if it's a little bit more official, you know, are you really going to rely on every participant to carry their phone, to keep it charged, to like not have it crashing all the time or full of space or, you know, whatever. It doesn't really make sense to rely on participants for certain events. Whereas if you can just have a dedicated tracker that you give to them and it's on and it's always on and they never have to touch it and they put it on their back or whatever and it goes. That's still an important piece. But for a bikepacking race, especially ones that are a little more laid back than others, you could say, yeah, a phone is fine. You don't need to have a spot or an inReach or rent one.
I feel you're speaking exactly to me because the reason I asked this is because I did one of these joker bike packing races recently this year. And yeah. And I was like, well, I'm not racing it. So I don't care that it's like super official and that it's, you know, it's tracking me every 10 seconds or minute or 5 minutes, whatever it is on a spot. And then also obviously like I'm not going to let my phone run out. It's my smartphone, right? Like these days we make sure that we our phone is working at all times, no matter what we're doing. So yeah, it seems like there's that opportunity. And this race was somewhere where I'm pretty sure there was, you know, cell coverage for 95% of it or whatever. So that makes sense that you kind of split that out. Like if this is a serious race, like there really isn't anything better than spot. But yeah, maybe for other races, there are other technologies.
Yeah. Which event did you do?
I did the Hurricane.
Oh, cool. Carlos's. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right on.
Yep. And right. And they use spots for that race as well. And it's on track leaders and everything. But yeah. There's plenty of not serious people, I guess, that do it, don't track it.
Yeah. And that's true of even on some of the more serious bikepacking races, only the, you know, maybe 20 or 30% are really racing hard. The rest are just, it's still, they're riding hard, but they maybe don't care as much about their placement and such.
Yeah.
And for people like that, yeah, a phone, even if you don't track for 10 hours or something. Right. That might be okay in certain situations. Yeah. But in other cases, if it's a 100-mile ultra race that has no cell coverage, then, you know, they need to know where everybody is all the time and they want someone pinging every 5 minutes. So that kind of a case, you know, I don't think is going to change in the next 5 years, possibly not the next 10 years because the limitations of satellites and higher bandwidth, I think, are a long ways out for being overcome.
Yeah. And it is interesting. I mean, you bring up a good point that the tracking is, you know, I mean, it sounds like initially the idea was, well, this is a way that people can like sort of follow along on the race. So it's kind of like a way to broadcast it. But really also you're talking safety. In terms of like race directors being able to know where people are on the course And then also, I mean, is it, do you feel like it's an accurate way to track a race? Like to know somebody finished the race and they stayed on the course and they finished, you know, start and finish at the time that they said they did? Like, is it a pretty accurate record of like finish times?
Yeah, I think it is. You know, you can't tell the difference between a sprint finish, right? Yeah. Two people, you know, finish within 10 seconds or even a couple of minutes of each other, then you have to rely on either someone there who saw them or self-reporting to say like, oh yeah, I crossed the line before this person did. But generally for a race that's, you know, a day or two or longer, you know, people are coming in much more spread apart. And it is pretty darn accurate as far as showing when people started, when they finished, and whether they stayed on the route, because it's very hard to fake. You know, it's just a device that's transmitting your location, and no one I know is sophisticated enough to hack a dedicated spot tracking device and change what it's transmitting to the satellites and to the ground stations. That does bring up an interesting point that with the phone tracker, that becomes much more of a possibility where people could, you know, someone could write a little app or something that, that hacks the tracking function and, and then transmit something that's not reality. But right now that's with a dedicated tracker. Yeah. That's very, very hard to fake.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess I'm thinking of like Strava too, where, I mean, they take data from any device. I mean, you can upload a file and it you know, counts that toward KOMs and things like that. And so, yeah, that, and we have heard, especially in the early days, we heard about e-doping, right? Like the idea people would manipulate.
Yeah, yeah. There was websites that you could upload.
Yeah.
Add 10%, you know, speed or whatever. And it was super easy to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But right, I guess you're saying with Spot, you can't do that. I mean, you're getting the data directly from Spot, I guess. Like they have some kind of API that gives you that data.
That's correct. Yeah. And so there's really no opportunity to mess with it in any way.
Do people ever say like, oh, my spot like malfunctioned, or, I mean, cause you do see that, like you'll see a weird waypoint or something and you can usually chalk that up to some kind of error.
Yeah. Usually you can tell, you know, most points will be on the route and then all of a sudden you get one or two that are clearly, you know, at the top of a peak or something. It was impossible for them to have gone up there, or it won't have, you know, shown that they cut the course randomly. It's not going to show them on the route. Most likely it's just an error, but, yeah, what you said there is the one way that there is an issue, and that's if they aren't tracking at all. You can't really say where they were or if they stayed on route, and that happens, you know, sometimes naturally, sometimes, I don't know, your tracker falls into the bottom of your pack or something and isn't transmitting well, or it runs out of batteries and you didn't notice.
Yeah.
And I think in very, very rare cases, we've had people turn their trackers off and then do something they did not want to be seen. Possibly not really cutting the course that I can think of, but definitely we've had people where they went off course, then they realized what had happened. And instead of, they didn't want to turn around and go back to the point where they lost the course. And so they turned their tracker off and then they returned to the course via a shorter route and then turned their tracker back on and kept going as though nothing had happened. Right.
Interesting.
And that, yeah. And that, you know, that's one where you just need a human to look at it and say like, well, okay, is it possible that they went back to where they were supposed to ride the whole route? Or is it impossible just based on the time? And so there's still ways to figure that out. But that is the one place where people could possibly cheat is, if they turn their tracker off or it happens to have turned off, then it's hard to say what they did. So the best thing, if you're getting a record or an FKT, is, you know, obviously to, have a complete full track with no real holes in it.
Even if you go off course, keep it running.
Yep, absolutely. Yep.
Cool. So, random GPS question for you. Why is elevation data so notoriously difficult to track with a GPS? Like, I mean, you know, people will go on a ride with their buddies and four people will have like four different elevation plots and four different, like, you know, climbs and descents. Why is it so hard still to get that data accurately?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it's the biggest thing is it's just an inherent limitation to satellite tracking in general, which is that you're if you think about triangulation, you're looking at time differences between the satellites you can see. But if you're on the surface of the Earth, you can only see satellites that are either above you or near the horizons. Mm-hmm. And you cannot see satellites that are below you, like on the other side of the Earth, right? Mm-hmm. Because the signal can't go through dirt or mantle. And so if you think about trying to triangulate a 2D location, if you've got a satellite on, say, directly to the north on the horizon and a satellite to the south, around the horizon, and you use those two time differences to figure out your distance between those two, mm-hmm. the errors cancel each other out, and you're going to get a really good fix in that way.
Okay.
But, and then same with east-west. And they don't have to be north-south, east-west, but if you have three or four satellites near the horizon in any reasonable direction, which you mostly do, given how the constellation works out, you're going to be able to get a really good 2D fix. Mm-hmm. But for 3D, all you have is basically the satellite that's right above you or any that are near and not anything below. And so the errors add up and it's a lot harder to accurately figure out your elevation. Then there's also some problems with like the model of the Earth because it's not a sphere, but it's also not an ellipsoid. Mm. And so approximating that, it can be difficult too. And then, I think the general rule is that if your 2D accuracy is say 1 meter, then your 3D would be, your elevation would be double that or 1.7 times that.
Okay.
So there's that source of error. But, if you're talking about comparing rides with your buddies and why a total climbing number is going to be off. Mm-hmm. The other thing to understand there, I think, is that it's a sum. So you're adding up differences in elevation as you go along on a ride. Mm-hmm. And so the more errors there are, it just accumulates as you go along. So that really can throw things off too. And so it's a challenge. You know, most software has, including TopoFusion, has some kind of filtering where it's smoothing the data mm-hmm. a little bit to get so that you don't add up so many small ups and downs that aren't actually there. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it can penalize it too. Like if you've got if there's actually little ups and downs on the trail, it can smooth those out. At some point you just have to kind of choose an algorithm and go with it. And especially if you're comparing between different apps like Strava and Garmin, you know, then there's going to be different, you know, variances and then different devices. And so, I always take a elevation gain number with a grain of salt, I guess. Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Same. And it's funny too, because like you said, this has always been a problem and there's a reason why it's a problem. Like it's not going to be solved, unfortunately. I mean,
yeah, there's not going to be like GPS version 2 that eliminates it. I mean, you know, anytime they make improvements in overall accuracy, that's good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it is kind of an inherent limitation to just determining a position on a sphere, on a planet with satellites. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And a lot of the devices now, they have like a barometric altimeter that's built in that I guess tries to like reconcile some of that and improve it some, but I've found that that doesn't really help. Like, do you have any opinion on that? Like as to whether that can give you better data or does it, I feel like it gets confused because barometric pressure also changes, right? Like the weather is constantly changing. So I don't know how that can make it better.
Yeah, that's right. You know, you could get a low pressure system or something coming in that changes it. I think it does help if you're one of those people who calibrates their altimeter, the barometric.
Yeah, that's probably what I'm doing wrong.
Yeah, but it takes effort. You know, I only know one person that I've ever seen do that before. Like before a ride, they're like, okay, what is the elevation here? And I'm going to plug that in to reset the barometric.
Right. How do you even know? Do you look for one of those like markers?
Yeah, survey marker. Yeah. Yeah. If you were really obsessive, you would. You'd like anytime you get to one of those USGS markers, you'd get that exact elevation and put it in. Yeah. But you know, if it's your house, you know, you can know, you know what your
right
elevation is there. Or you can look at a topo map if you're camping somewhere or a trailhead. But yeah, I think that takes it to a little bit of an obsessive level.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I don't think that barometric really totally solves that. In some cases, it can make it better, but it's definitely not a silver bullet.
Yeah. Well, so I mentioned you're currently coming to us live from your van somewhere in Utah. When did you fully commit to the digital nomad lifestyle, and how did you make that jump?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess for us, meaning me and my partner, Esther, it was kind of just a natural progression. We lived in Tucson for a bit, and when I was a grad student, I never spent the summer there. And so we were always going to Colorado or other places that were cooler and never really staying in one place for an entire year. Mm-hmm. And then in 2014, we spent the summer, 4 months of the summer living off our bikes while riding the Continental Divide Trail.
Cool.
Yeah. And so we did that. And then in 2015, we were living out of a minivan. So we upgraded to a minivan and just traveled all over the West. And then in 2016, we finally got a Scamp trailer, which is a little 13-foot fiberglass eggshell, kind of a small trailer. Mm-hmm. And we towed it with the minivan. And, you know, yeah, people asked us then, like, how can you live out of just a tiny little Scamp trailer? And we thought, well, this is a luxury compared to just the minivan or just what we can carry on our bikes.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it wasn't necessarily like a hard, like, oh, we're going like full time mobile all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. Just sort of grew naturally. And, but when we did do this camp, we did like fully, you know, didn't have a storage unit, weren't renting a place or anything anymore.
Wow.
And that was 2016. So it was a little bit of a jump. And there was a couple things to figure out as far as to how we were going to work effectively and keep computers charged and get internet and all that kind of stuff. And the pandemic sort of forced us to upgrade to a bigger trailer where we had, we couldn't spend as much time in coffee shops and libraries and even friends' houses, it seemed like, at the time, especially at the beginning. And so we got a bigger trailer that has a bathroom and more power and cell boosters. And this year got the Starlink satellite internet set up, which has been pretty amazing too. So yeah, it's just been kind of a progression, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. That's interesting that, yeah, you kind of started from like something really tiny, like living off your bike to living, you know, out of a minivan, which, you know, by comparison is a step up. I think a lot of us imagine like, you know, we're living in a house or an apartment or whatever and imagine like going down in terms of our space and, and our lifestyle. But yeah, for you, it's like, you know, get really, really low. And then whatever you do from there is going to feel like an upgrade.
Yeah, that's right. I think that's maybe a little bit of a trick that we kind of told ourselves anyway.
Yeah. Seems to have worked.
Yeah, like make it seem luxurious and be like, oh, look, you know, when it rains, we don't have to like look for a tree to hide under because we have a tree.
yeah, it's the little things.
Yep.
So, yeah, do you have any tips for people who are like, what, when people find out that you're living this lifestyle and, you know, maybe they've considered it, what are the things that they're most concerned about that they're like, oh, well, how do you do this? Like, what is the biggest tips you can give the people who are thinking about doing that?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people ask us about internet, like how we're able to work and power computers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Starlink is pretty amazing, but you don't need it. We just operated off our phones. We just using them as a hotspot. No dedicated Wi-Fi thing or anything. And that actually worked pretty well. You know, you're limited to camping somewhere where there's cell signal. But and it depends on what your job is. You know, neither of us do a lot of necessarily high bandwidth stuff. If you're doing Zoom meetings and that all the time, something like Starlink makes a lot more sense. And it would have been pretty challenging to do that without it, just with cell-based stuff. But if you're just programming and logging into servers or, you know, sending emails and stuff, that's pretty low bandwidth. And powering stuff is super easy with solar. It's amazing how little power you can get away with, you know, in any kind of a mobile setup. But tips for going to the full nomad. The one thing I would say, I guess, is that to realize that there's many, many different ways to do it. And to not look at any one particular person or YouTube or anything and be like, that's what mobile life is, right? That there's ways to do it that are super cheap and are way cheaper than living in even a cheap apartment. There's ways to do it that are expensive, more expensive than owning a house. And everything in between. And there's ways to do it where you're camping free and or staying in campgrounds or RV parks or staying in one place for a long time or moving around. You know, there's so much variety in it. And I guess the thing I would say to someone considering it anew is just don't have a set idea of how it's going to be. Like you have to kind of find your style of camping and mobile living. It's really hard to know what that's going to be without trying it. Whether you're the kind of person that, wants to stay in, you know, maybe move twice a year or three times a year, or whether you're going to want to move around and really follow the good weather and explore a lot. So yeah, don't have any hard expectations of what those decisions are going to be until you get out there. And so I guess with that in mind, go with the cheaper way of starting it. And that way you're not too invested in one style, because depending on how those things all shake out, you know, then a van makes more sense than a big RV, and and you know, kind of those decisions could be different. So
yeah, that's a good point. Everybody's got like different interests and priorities, and but it is fascinating to me that the first thing you said that people ask about is like internet and charging devices. Whereas I don't know, I assumed it would be like, where do I go to the bathroom? Or like, how do I get food and cook it? Like, you know, more basic functions. But I guess this is 2022. And so, yeah, we, you know, we have different priorities.
Yeah. I think that's right. Especially if you're trying to work, you know, then the internet becomes pretty important too.
Exactly. Right. Everybody has different work situations and, responsibilities that they still have to maintain. So when you go for a ride in a new place, do you rely on GPS or a smartphone, or do you also pack a paper map?
I would say, like, if I'm doing a new route I haven't done before, the main thing I would rely on is a well-researched GPX track, I drew, I figured out, or I pieced together from other people's tracks and research. And so once I've got that loaded on my Garmin, on my handlebars, or on my phone if it's on foot, you know, then I'm pretty confident in that track and that I can follow it and make small adjustments. But that's the main thing I would rely on. It's pretty rare that I actually carry a paper map. Paper maps are fun to look at and good for daydreaming and, you know, big idea. You know, we have a good collection that we haul around, even though we're mobile, pretty heavy box of maps and guidebooks and stuff. And they're worth it. They're totally awesome. But yeah, to carry them is pretty rare.
Yeah. I wasn't sure how you would answer that. Like, I could see you going either way, like being a traditionalist or being, you know, fully invested in this digital world that we're in. And like, so do you have like a backup though? Like, that's one of the things I'm starting to think about is, what do we do when our device fails? And I mean, I guess you know better than anybody, like, what are the chances of that happening? But yeah, what would you do if your GPS just stopped working for some reason?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can even just smash it, like crash on a rock something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, if it's something long enough, probably the best thing to do is you can carry a spare device, which, yes, if I'm on my own, maybe I'd have it on my Garmin and also on my phone, mm-hmm. and prefer to navigate off the handlebars. But if you need to, look at the phone. But the other thing is relying on other people that you might have that are coming with you. So like a couple days ago, I did a ride with Esther and a friend that was camping with us, and I just emailed that GPX file out so that it was on multiple people's devices. Partly for as a failsafe, but also just because then they could help me navigate it if I am not paying attention and miss a turn or something. But I don't know. I myself don't often consider bringing a map. I don't know why exactly.
I haven't brought one in years, but I mean, I feel like there was a point where I was like, oh, I really like paper and I still kind of appreciate that. But I guess there was a point where I just said, no, like I don't need that anymore.
Yeah, it's not that they're that heavy, really, but I don't know. For some reason, I guess I've just been my whole adventure in life, I've pretty much been a GPS guy. When I started doing new rides outside of established trail systems, I was always loading tracks and looking at tracks, and so that's just the way I operate. Maybe I'm just not old enough to.
You're digital native. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Yes.
So, what are you planning for your next adventure, be it an outdoor adventure or business venture?
We just booked our tickets to go to New Zealand for this winter.
Oh, cool.
So I think that's going to be the next big adventure.
Which How are you going to get your trailer over there?
Yeah, I wish. we started going to New Zealand in the winters once we had this camp, just because I'm not that interested in camping when the days are so short. Mm-hmm. Even if you're down somewhere warm like Arizona, it's still winter, and it's still mm-hmm. quite dark. And one of the really cool things about being mobile is that we don't have expenses really at home, so we can park the back in the U.S. We can park the trailer and our at a friend's house or something, and mm-hmm. not be paying for mortgage and stuff, and then go to New Zealand and be relatively unencumbered. So taking advantage of that, it's pretty cool. And then getting another summer solstice instead of a winter solstice is
two summers. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yep. And then, just continue exploring and riding bikes and scrambling around on foot, doing a little pack rafting down there as well. Should be awesome.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for taking the time to chat. It was great catching up and hearing about all the cool projects that you're a part of. And I can't wait to see what you're up to next.
Yeah. Thanks, Jeff. It was great being on here. And it'll be interesting to see how single tracks goes in the next 20 years.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Well, you can find out more about Topo Fusion and Track Leaders online, and we'll have links to those in the show notes. That's all I've got this week. We'll talk to you again next week.